This is the Packet Pushers podcast, a place where more than 30 years of networking hasn't gathered any dust, just a pile of unpaid invoices that's really just technical debt with a fancy name to get it past the purchasing clerks. And what we're trying to work out this week is if the creditors are coming to collect this quarter or next year. Today's show is the latest in our Future of Networking series, where we peer over the horizon to speculate about what the future will hold. Our guest today is a returning guest, someone who was super popular when we brought him on last time. His name is Jeff Houston, Chief Scientist at AppNIC, which serves IP addresses for the Asia-Pac region. He's been in computer science and networking since the 1980s, God bless his soul, including 10 years in the telecom trenches. Join us for a far-ranging and potentially contrarian conversation on a variety of topics, including specifically this time on internet transit or various rabbit holes that we may find as we go down. Welcome, Jeff, to the show.
Thanks for having me again. It's fun to be here.
Ah, you say that so politely. We had so much fun last time, and when I bumped into you at IETF in Berlin, and I just said thanks so much, and you were very kind to say, perhaps a little bit foolish to say, let's do it again. So this is that.
Well, you know, let's do it again. And you know, fortuitously, the headlines are just playing right into this. Level three is for sale, and CenturyLink wants to buy them. Who's the crazy people?
Well, yeah, $50-odd billion, isn't it?
Oh, way too much.
Yeah, like, you know, just vast sums of money.
Vast sums of money, but you know, the real question is, what are Level 3 bringing to the party?
Yes, well, okay. Yeah, and they're out today too, by the way. They're down. They're having major problems on the East Coast of America.
The real question, though, is not that they're down.
No.
Will anyone notice? Will anyone notice at all? You see, 30 years ago, if AT&T in the United States was down, you know, bad things would happen all over the country because it was the sort of the mainstay of the way the public communication system worked. Mm. And now what we're finding is major transit systems can be down and it's really not user visible. Something's changed. Something really dramatic has changed. And I think this kind of is going to rock a fair deal of what we thought about in terms of traditional networking, all the way through to names and addresses. Everything gets changed.
Mm. Oh, and I'm looking at the downdetector.com, and there's a massive outage on the East Coast of America for Level 3. I'm sure people on the East Coast of America are suffering, but no one else in the world is.
Well, you know, if they can get to Google, LinkedIn, Facebook, Amazon, they won't care.
No, I actually don't think they will. And I guess that's your point is...
Exactly. The issue is that if you're going to where people want you to go, it doesn't matter if you can't reach Reykjavik this second. I'm sure it's sad for the people in Reykjavik, but, you know, for the rest of the world, sort of, oh, yeah. And that's a strange sort of place to be. Mm. Now, a lot of the ethos of networking actually came from the old telephony world, which actually got its ethos from the postal system. This idea of sort of universal reachability. Doesn't matter what address I put on the envelope, the postal system will deliver. You know, that was the social contract. And when the US Congress, bless its little heart, granted AT&T a monopoly way back in 1916, little did they know, the fools, when they did that, there was a social contract about universal connectivity. The telephone network was meant to reach everybody, and anybody could ring anyone else.
Right.
So it was neutral. It really sort of didn't channel all the calls to you or to me or to, you know, to someone else. Anyone could call anyone.
But importantly, there couldn't be a middle person in it. Like, you couldn't talk to somebody in the middle. It always had to be person to person or endpoint to endpoint.
Right. It's not, let's all talk to Bill and Bill will relay the message. Thanks, Bill. You know, whoever it might be, that was never the model. Mm. It was the idea that the network simply allowed two folk to connect. Mm. And if you look at the early development of computer protocols, all of that was in there. This idea that all the computers were kind of equal citizens on a computer network, and we created global addressing systems so that literally when you connected your computer to the internet, this was before the day of days of malware and that kind of nonsense, right?
Yeah.
You connected your internet, you could reach, as soon as you put that plug in, anybody. Any other computer was visible.
Hmm.
Yeah, you know, in those good old days when we all liked and trusted each other, it seemed like a really good idea.
Yes.
A few ideas later, it seemed like the stupidest idea ever invented, and, you know, we regret it bitterly because it was all a mistake.
Well, but hang on. I think there's an issue here. I think the point is that we had to assume trust between two endpoints in the early stages of the internet because the burden of securing or creating trust of the security issues that we would have had to solve, and the internet may never have been built. I don't think we only have a security problem today because we didn't put security in the past, and by not putting security in, we actually built something that we can use.
Well, I'm not sure that that was ever really the issue of whether we put it in from the start or not. Mm. The real issue is, irrespective of how much security you wrap around the transaction on the wire,
yeah,
when my computer talks to your computer, if your computer is an evil intended thing, I've got a problem. And you can't kind of wrap the cotton wool of security around that issue, right?
No.
But, you know, my issue was, I think that we built computer networks to look like the phone network.
Mm.
We actually thought that universal connectivity and universal reachability was brilliant. Do you know what set the internet apart from DECnet? What made it different? One thing was, it was a better protocol. I'm like, DECnet sucked.
Yeah, DECnet was traumatic. Although it had MOP. There was a lot to be said for MOP.
There was nothing to be said for MOP.
I quite liked MOP. No. As an operator, at least I knew exactly how to operate.
Part of the issue was with DECnet, it had router-to-router flow control, and that was just crazy. Mm. IP dropped that and did all flow control end-to-end, and that's what made IP different. But IP would have died a death had it not started with global addressing and set up an address registry run by SRI in the early days, where anyone on the planet could ask them via fax. You remember faxes? We're talking banging the rocks together, right? They could get a unique address that no one else had. And if they configured their computer and their infrastructure with that unique address, they were on. As soon as they found a wire somewhere, they were connected.
Back in those days, the idea of letting DECnet out of control of DEC wasn't a thing. Everybody in those days built their own protocol, and the idea was it was locked to their technology so that you couldn't.
Everyone built an addressing system which was based around the corporate or the plant.
Yes.
Like I said, on DECnet, everyone was Area 1, Node 1. You know, I'm going to be Area 1 today. Who cares?
That's what you get when you ask the customers what they want. I want a network that works inside of my enterprise.
Hang on a second. Don't go there because the internet is what the customers want today, and that's where we're going to end up.
But they wouldn't have asked for that. I love annoying vendors and saying, don't talk to the customers and ask them what they want because they don't know what they want. And if you had I quite clearly remember talking to vendors and saying, what I want is to have a better WAN, a corporate WAN. You wouldn't have built the internet to replace corporate WANs.
No, you wouldn't. Hmm. But we always follow the money, and irrespective, you know, the money comes from consumers. So, you know, what distinguished the internet at the time is actually something we don't value anymore. That unique addressing, that global reachability, that idea that we could send a packet from any connected computer to any other was what we thought was really important. And look at us now.
Mm.
The first thing we did was distinguish between what we called clients and what we called servers.
Right.
Now, a computer doesn't know which it is. I'm like, it has an identity problem, doesn't it? Hello, what will I be today, client or server? Well, I don't know.
It depends if I'm requesting, making the request or receiving a request.
Well, in each transaction, yes, but we put NATs in front of all the clients and said, you can't be a server. Doesn't matter how you feel today, you can't be a server. My Mac used to have some kind of stuff that said, go and be a web server. I'm not sure if it's still there anymore because, quite frankly, my Mac lives behind NATs 24 hours a day, and it doesn't matter what it serves. No one can see it. It's kind of talking to itself. I'm having a good day today. I'll be a web server. Geez, no clients. So when we segmented the network, all of a sudden, it wasn't a case that anyone could speak to anyone. Everyone could speak to a select few. And we're back to a telephone network where everyone talks to Bill, right?
Mm.
Hi, Bill. And that was kind of weird because we went there without thinking. We really didn't think about it. We just thought, wow, it's a vicious world. We're running out of addresses. We can't do all this stuff. Wow, let's share addresses and let's put clients behind sharing and let's make the servers the ones with real addresses. So let's sort of have Class A citizens and Class B citizens, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good. Then we started looking at how is this all working? And I suppose one of the best issues was a Facebook presentation in NAOG, the North American Network Operators Group, a couple of weeks ago, where they pointed out back in 2011 they were running out of three data centers, and that meant they spanned the world. Two on the west coast of the US, one on the east coast. Good enough? You're sort of sitting there and you're on Australia going, I'm like, it's across the Pacific. No matter what you do, shit, right? It's there and back without going for coffee in the middle.
Oh, I remember.
Oh, we all do.
I lived in Brisbane and I grew up, you know, on the east coast of Australia. And I mean, I was jealous of the people in Sydney because they got an extra 22 milliseconds less latency.
Right. All of this stuff made a difference because small number of servers, and the job of the internet was then to connect clients to the servers. And if you live next door to the server, you're in seventh heaven. You know, if Google was your next door neighbor, you were right. But if, you know, Google was on the other side of the planet, then you got a problem. Of course, the problem's physics. Damn them.
Yeah.
100 years ago, this whole thing about, you know, relativity, everything else bends.
I heard a great saying. I heard a great saying this week. Bandwidth you can buy, but latency comes from the gods.
Latency does come from the gods. The only folk who are doing something about latency is continental drift. The geologists will save us.
But that's on a time scale.
Oh, yeah, you and I won't see it, but they will save us. They are working on it.
Yeah.
But, you know, until then, you've got to live with just this extraordinary latency if you're on the wrong side of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the content folk weren't happy. I mean, their dreams of global domination were really, really big. And, you know, this whole issue of latency was really bad. Now, I remember talking in Telstra, where I was working at the time, and one of the answers from one of the executives was, well, why don't you talk to Microsoft and get them to put bigger buffers in their machine? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard, you know. Why are you in charge of this? It just doesn't work like that. Larger buffers and buffering things up at either end just cannot mistake the fact that you've got a latency problem. I want to go to your web page, fine. I've got to do a DNS dance. If it's a new name that isn't cached locally, that's around 3 round trip times across the other side of the planet. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then I do TCP SYN handshakes. That's another round trip time. And then because we're all doing super duper encryption these days, I've got to do a TLS handshake or two. 6 round trip times before I've even said hello. That's a second.
Mm-hmm.
And in a kind of a billion-dollar millisecond world, that's unacceptable.
Mm.
And so the content folk, after thinking very hard about this, and Netscape came up with the first one, which was a little bit kind of ropey, but it sort of worked. It said, you are where your DNS is. I'm not. But it was a good theory.
Yeah. It was at the time, because your DNS probably represented the network you were connected to. Enterprise or a carrier, if you were on a, you know, Telstra backbone in Australia or a Comcast backbone, your DNS probably was quite close to you at that point in time.
That was the days before Google's public DNS.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago, right?
Yeah, well, yes.
The world has changed. But, you know, it was this idea that if you are your DNS, you know, and you're not, but if you are, tell you what, we'll answer you, your DNS query, with an address that's close to your resolver. So I have a variety of addresses, but I'll give you the one that I think's best for you. Mm. Yeah?
Mm.
But then we thought about this a lot more because you can, and you know, it's a competitive world out there. And we cottoned on to a thing called Anycast. And Anycast is kind of strange.
Mm.
It's DNA replication. I reproduce exactly the same thing, and I just put it in multiple locations with the same IP address. Now the routing system will automatically deliver me to my closest instance of that thing. And you go, well, that sounds pretty ropey. And the answer is, well, the root system of the DNS has been using it for 10 years. If it's pretty ropey, addresses wouldn't translate. Get that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's sort of, well, shit, that works, doesn't it? The DNS seems to operate. Yeah.
Yep.
Scratch its head seems to be okay. And so we started doing Anycast like crazy. But that was sort of interesting because that brought content close to users rather than users to content.
Right. So Anycast is the point. So just for the people who aren't keeping up, Anycast is where you might have the same, let's say you've got a 130.1.1.1, a public IP address. What you might choose to do is to have 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 servers around the world with the IP address of, or if the subnet, 130.1.1/24, and you announce that into the BGP table in the global routing, and you would be routed theoretically to the nearest one in the internet.
Yes,
to you, because BGP would calculate the lowest number of hops.
The magic of BGP would get you the lowest number of hops, and on the theory that BGP gives you lower latency, a bit of a ropey theory.
Yeah, not a good theory, but workable in practice. Not a bad theory in practice, yeah.
So we started playing with Anycast, and Anycast got popular. And then we started back with playing with the DNS again, because Anycast is still not quite good enough. And so we started doing even more work in the DNS and started to say, well, how can we contain some information about the customer in the query to give them an address of a data center really close to them? And we're doing really good at that. If you look at what Akamai are doing, what Cloudflare, what Netflix and so on are doing, they site themselves at major population centers. They put in their content inside data centers and they then deliver from there. As long as they can collect the customers, intercept their traffic and go, you're serving, you're talking to me.
Well, no, they're not intercepting. I think that's bad language there, I think, because they're not actually intercepting the traffic. They're the endpoint for the traffic.
Well, yes and no, and it gets pretty weird.
Well,
if, for example, I get sent over to a data center in San Francisco, which for me in Australia is a bad choice. Once I expose my end address and the whole DNS thing has done its dance, the data center in San Francisco will hand me over to the one in Sydney. Now, you're right. They're not inspecting packets on the wire. It's nothing like that.
This not is like they used to. They used to run big web caching web proxies, which would take your request and literally intercept it, and the local web proxy would steal your HTTP requests.
We played with one of those in Telstra back in 1996. It was the stupidest idea ever invented, and I wish it never was. I don't know what we were thinking. shouldn't have done that. Yeah. Craziest idea
to mankind. I've done a bunch of them over the years for telcos, small-scale carriers, and all obviously for enterprise, where they actually capture all the HTTP and HTTPS traffic for that matter. So they can log what people are looking at. But telcos do it to do bandwidth reduction. So by caching it, they can do that. And some carriers use the web proxies to be able to inject their own ads in. So they would replace other people's ads with their own.
Let's talk a little bit about bandwidth reduction and actually understand what's going on here. The telephone system used to work on an 80-20 rule. 80% of the calls were local, 20% were long distance. Because you phoned people you knew. And I'm sure the postal system has an 80-20 rule. So 20% is from far away, 80% is local. We built a phone system based on the 80-20 rule. All the switching capacity is local. The transit stuff, long distance, international was a much smaller. Mother's Day is an international disaster every day, bastards. Because, you know, this is not enough capacity for everyone in the world to ring some mother somewhere on the other side of the world, right? The internet, because it was distance independent, flipped that on its head. Servers were a long way away because there are more servers everywhere else than locally. And 70% of the traffic, particularly in Australia, was being brought into the country on a system that overlaid telephony. So the underlying system had almost zilch capacity in and out of the country. All the capacity was local, but all the traffic on the internet wasn't. Huge mismatch. So we started doing sort of caching and traffic interception and all the other tricks to try and reduce the amount of traffic on the scarce resource, the long distance wire. Now, the data center, the content folk said, scratched their head and said, you know, you're doing all this work, but we're delivering lousy service because we're still at the other end of a long wire. Tell you what, if there are enough of you using my content, and if the economics work of putting in a data center close to you, I'll just do that and circumvent the problem. And so today, where do people go? They go to Facebook, they go to LinkedIn, they go to Google. Presentation by Comcast, the major US retail access provider, 34 million customers or something. On an average day, 384 routing entries satisfy almost the entirety of their traffic. So there might be lots of people, but they're all going to the same place.
If you put
those 380-odd places in a local centre, there is no long-distance traffic. There is no data problem anymore. There's nothing to ration. And so all of a sudden, the whole economics of trying to preserve this scarce resource, the content folks said, we'll solve your problem for you. It's okay. Right. Data centers are cheap. Computers are cheap. We're going to bring the content under the user's nose. You don't have a problem anymore.
So what you're saying there is that we used to backhaul all the traffic to data centers. So in Australia, for example, traffic would backhaul all the way to the US and you'd poll a web server there. Or, you know, it might go to Europe and the traffic might loop through the US to get to Europe, you know, a European data center, and then it would come all the way back. But now what we're doing is we're moving the content from the server into a content delivery network, which then effectively puts the content very close to you, which defeats the tyranny of latency. So when you want to hit your Facebook page or whatever, chances are it's cached quite locally to you, or Facebook might even be keeping a copy close to you. Because as you say, data centers are cheap, power is relatively cheap, cheaper than international bandwidth for sure. And the lower the latency, the faster your site is, the more money you make from presenting ads to people. That's still the rule today. But what you're also pointing out is that the secondary effect here is that backbones that used to be premium bandwidth that were absolutely overloaded, and we were always concerned about how much bandwidth was actually in the fiber, say, under the ocean, and who was going to install the next cable to give us an upgrade and all that sort of stuff. That's no longer a premium product. That's no longer a shortage. There's no longer a rarity of that.
It's no longer a rarity. Mm. Six of the last submarine cable projects have not been funded from the traditional telco, transit, ISP sector. Mm-hmm. They've been funded by Microsoft, Google, and the others. They're being funded by the content data networks and the data distribution systems. Mm-hmm. They're not being funded to carry user traffic. Users aren't being shipped around to see content. Mm. Content is being shipped closer to users.
I was at a conference and Google said that they are the biggest service provider network in the world today.
Well, you know, to some extent, I suppose if they measure their petabytes, you know, who has more, that would be a reasonable guess.
Yeah.
Akamai are pretty big. Netflix is really big in terms of the petabytes.
But they deliver everything. They don't move a lot of data. Netflix doesn't, because they're CDN, they have a lot of pops, but they don't actually move too much traffic around the backbone.
Right, because the data is kind of fixed and predictable. Yeah, Facebook that's right. has slightly more of a problem. Yes. But I'm pretty sure if I wandered around Facebook friends in Estonia, I'd see noticeable delays as distinct from Facebook friends in Australia. Mm. They're selective in what they bring locally. Mm. You know, and that's quite normal. That's a normal and rational decision about the way in which they move their content around.
Sure, right? but they're deploying their own bandwidth. So instead of using backbone providers like Level 3 or, you know, however the old transit providers of the internet used to be, these companies are now putting their bandwidth onto their own dedicated circuits because A, they can afford to buy them, B, they can control the bandwidth that's available. They know exactly how much bandwidth there is and they can connect, you know, sync their data centers together or replicate their traffic and, you know.
Right. So at the same time, what they're doing is stripping money out of carriage and putting it into content.
Yes.
Don't forget, if 70% of your traffic was long distance that you were selling to customers, then a huge amount of the money went into transit. And indeed, we had this whole idea of a tiered ecosystem of the internet. Local access providers were the kind of the dross at the bottom of the sewerage pipe. They were the mud and the slime. Mm-hmm. And then above that were sort of the regional transits who could beat their chest. And then on top of that were the sort of international long-haul operators who were where all the money went. Because ultimately you paid your upstream for transit, who paid theirs. And in a small number, I think there are about 10 tier one networks that absorbed all this money. And that was the El Dorado, you know, the thing to be on the internet. I want to be a tier one transit. Everyone has gone around them. And the money that we used to spend on them is become content money that the content folk are actually capitalizing on. Right. Because the current model of the internet is access provider, local exchange, data center.
And that data center is probably within 500 miles of where, or 1,000 miles.
The objective is it's within 500 miles of major GDP centers where there's major wealth.
Yeah.
If you're not living in major wealth, there's still a certain amount of transit involved. Hmm. But at some point, you know, it all just gets closer. And the next thing is, not all the content is close to you, only the bits you need. This is the difference between a library and a bookshop. In theory, if you go to the library, you know, big thing, lots and lots of books, hardly anyone reads any individual book, but if you need it, it's there. It's a sort of just-in-case model of provisioning. Mm. This industry spends, I reckon, 90% of its money on crap, on just-in-case stuff that no one uses, nobody uses. Why does your TCAM have a million entries if you only go to 384 destinations? I'm like, we over-provision just-in-case. The content data network does entirely the different thing. It does not just in case. It does just in time. So the content in my local data center is probably content that I'm likely to use. And the stuff that I'm not likely to use, they kind of go, eh, don't care.
Yeah.
Like my bookshop. The books in a bookshop are the ones that are going to sell. Because if you have any other business model, you're not a bookshop anymore. Right? You go, bro.
Yeah.
And you know, we're now using, if you will, smarter ways of delivering content to make the entire economics of content delivery much, much cheaper than the old economics of carriage. So instead of taking users to libraries, the bookshops are appearing right in front of your face. They don't contain everything, but we can get that if you need it. They contain what you're likely to use. And that's a really revolutionary look at this network. Now, all kinds of things happen after that. If most of my packets go to a data center that's local to me, do I need global addressing? What's the Internet of Things? Why do I need the DNS? Why is there one internet? Well, my packets are local. Do I care?
Jeff, we need global addressing so we can execute DDoS attacks.
Yeah, well, I think that is about the last remaining reason why we have it. You know, this whole idea that there's this social contract that says universal connectivity is a myth. There is no such contract. We are not AT&T. There's no deal with any government that we have to do everything. We're just like a retailer, and we spend all of our money satisfying 90% of the need. The other 10% is probably uneconomic. And so, yes, the only thing that's exploiting global connectivity is stuff we're scratching our head going, how the hell can we fix it? And you know what the answer is? Turn it off. Just turn it off. No one uses it. You could actually satisfy almost everything folk do. Where's email in a data center? Where's the web in a data center? Where's everything you do? Well, they're in data centers. I saw these studies about they were putting probes all through the network, and they were trying to demonstrate that probes in Australia talking to other probes in Australia, user to user, did the traffic stay in Australia? And if it didn't, that's a very bad thing, isn't it? Users talking to other users in Australia have their traffic leaving the country. You sit there and scratch your head and go, aside from BitTorrent, what else goes from user to user? And the answer is nothing.
No, yeah, pretty much nothing. Everything's hosted nothing. On. But a lot of the content in web servers is all the same stuff over and over and over in the sense.
And you sort of go, well, isn't it expensive to put, you know, content on your content distribution network? I don't know about you and you, but Cloudflare do that service for free.
Yeah, they do. It doesn't cost
free.
Much. They're actually contributing so much to open source projects, it's a wonder they've got anything left to do.
So I can do global caching of my content as a dumb user who was sitting behind my NAT that couldn't make my web server work. I go to Cloudflare for free and say, make my web server work again. And they go, no, have we got news for you, Jeff? It will just not work. It will work within milliseconds of most of the user's population of the planet. Wow. And we'll sustain DDoS attacks of up to a few gigabytes. Wow. And we're not going to charge you anything. Wow. Santa Claus exists, you know. This is the Easter Bunny come to deliver. Now, if I really want, you know, super cool stuff, I'll go to Akamai and pay them more money. I'll go to others, and that's also cool. But somehow or other, we have stripped out the internet and said transit doesn't mean anything anymore.
So what does this matter? Why does transit matter then? Let me ask you that question, right? If you're saying that transit doesn't matter And there's been a massive shift in revenues for the transit providers, like Level 3, right, which is now up for sale, as you've said, and somebody wants to buy it, strangely. What does this mean for the internet ecosystem? Does this mean there's a shift of power away from the transit providers? Is this affecting things like IANA, ICANN, IETF, you know, NANOGS? Who's contributing code to NANOGS? Or is it just an observation that things have changed and systems continue to run as normal? Is that what you're concluding?
Oh, no. Things changed dramatically. Mm. You ever been to Finland lately?
No.
Very small number of euros, and I do mean very small number. If you come off the plane, they'll sell you a SIM. You whack it in your phone, it runs 4G.
Yes.
It runs extraordinarily fast, and there is no data cap.
Yeah.
None. Just none. Mm. Knock yourself out.
Because, well, I've got that here in the UK.
But data doesn't matter anymore. So we're seeing the rise of unlimited plans.
You're saying this is why data doesn't matter, is because it's nearly always
so
local. It's not being...
All the caps are going away, so it's sort of, why should I ration you? Because, quite frankly, I'm not moving the data anymore. So, you know, knock yourself out. Try and drain the data center of content if you want. You know, it's your problem. There's no limit anymore because there's no scarce resource anymore in the pooled resource area.
Mm.
We're not trying to share a thin wire snaking its way across the seafloor. You know, we're not trying to melt a satellite with radiation anymore. This is just the stuff that we're just not doing. So all of a sudden, data's free. There is no data cap. Everything is unlimited. And that's one of the first consequences. But the second consequence is kind of, why do we put a million entries in our high-speed router switches? Well, because we think traffic could go anywhere. But does it? Why is that router so expensive? Well, because there's a million entries in a high-speed, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah.
And the issue is, exactly, it's kind of, but you're provisioning the wrong part of your router and spending all this money on something that traffic doesn't want or need. And so part of the conversation
is... It was a Spotify that built the internet router, Jeff, that where they significantly curbed in their regional routers the number of routes they were carrying for this reason. They didn't need to talk to the whole internet. It was very specific in their BGP SDN solution, and whatever you want to call it, only programmed the forwarding entries that they really needed to speak to the regional networks that were required.
Yes, and a presentation by Fastly, again at NANOG in the last couple of weeks, talked about partial fibs where the same issues going on. I'm like, again, like a bookshop, I only stock the books that people want to buy. I only need the routes the traffic wants to use. And the rest is kind of, well, you're esoteric. Do I need to offer you exactly the same grade of service if you just offer me one packet every fortnight? The answer is, well, don't see why I should bother. And so we are trying to sort of understand, and as we try and sort of drill down on cost, because it is a competitive world, you're sort of looking at what things you do because of unthinking habit and what things you need to do to make money. And part of this massive over-provisioning is phenomenally expensive. You know, your routers cost a major fortune. And the answer is, well, why? Well, because someone might send a packet to this unknown address. It sort of doesn't need to happen.
Mm.
Not if the data center's right underneath your nose.
It doesn't.
And the fascinating thing is, all of the work is actually happening inside the data center. I saw the most amazing example coming from Facebook, where they're using IPv6 as the fundamental backplane of an old mainframe model to create the virtual mainframe computer of the 21st century. So every process has a 128-bit identifier, 64 bits. Sound familiar? 64 bits happens to be sort of the identity of the process, the engine you're using, and the other 64 bits is a unique processor ID that no matter where that process is running, it has the same ID. We're kind of recycling that technology back into data centers.
Yep.
Because it's the data centers that's actually the forefront of our attention. The content distribution networks are actually the focus of everyone's attention. And literally,
I don't know about that. I mean, so I agree that certainly we're seeing big investments by the networking companies in data centers, but not in enterprise data centers. Enterprise data centers are kind of, that's a shrinking market. But there's a lot of money in telco data centers. And I think this is what you're pushing at, or I think this is what I'm thinking about, is that telcos want to build content delivery networks because that's where the money, they want to capture that revenue, that is not let the data go off to the transit backbones. They want to store it locally. So having a data center where companies like Netflix and Cloudflare can come and put their gear, which doesn't cost them anything, which means that the traffic doesn't have to go upstream and reduces the load on their own backbones. They don't even have to pay for those POPs, by the way. You just have to be a big enough network and they'll come and put them there for free. That's really what's changing the economics of the internet. Well, that's a key factor in changing the economics of the internet backbones.
Right. So somewhere between the exchange operators, and there are some biggies who sort of started there, like AMSIX and DE Kicks in Europe. Somewhere between that and the residual telco industry, the focus is now on these sort of large black holes of data, you know, the large local exchange that has, it's just rammed full of content and has sort of small hops to as many users as possible. And that's sort of where all the attention is coming from this industry. And it makes a huge amount of sense. But what it does also mean is, why do we sort of try and have globally unique addressing systems, globally unique names, when in actual fact, there is no need? You know, and this comes the crunch point of how much does that cost us and how much are customers willing to pay? Because the death of enterprise comes almost soon afterwards. I'm sorry, but it's going to. It's another dinosaur. How many enterprises run their own mail system in the onslaught of Gmail just taking the world's mail? At some point,
Azure's taking
your little
most of
enterprise,
the corporate
tiny mirror of the universe is so expensive, you might as well just buy a bit of the public service and segment yourself, you know, in that little corner.
Well, I think the point here is that I think with email, well, when I think about email, the point is that email has so little value, there's no point in linking it to your business. You are just as easily served getting rid of that business because now you can.
Right, so now I go into teamware, slackware, you know, I'm here with it, I'm with the latest, but they're all content distribution network centric. You know, the enterprise is a virtual part of a public service. You don't run your own machinery. You don't hide behind some mythical bunker. All that's disappeared now. And I suppose the real issue is now that what we're seeing is kind of this service specialization because we can, sitting inside content distribution systems because we can. And now we've made it really easy to sort of fan that out with on-demand back-end systems, content distribution networks, and created, if you will, little local areas of networking that simply draw customers and enterprise into this local data switch, the local exchange, that then has all the content distribution there. Now, that's a different world from the one we knew. That's entirely different. Everything about that world is different.
So there's a massive – so you're pointing to the fact that the money has moved, and there's also a technology transition that comes here as well. So as the money moves away from a given point in the internet, so does the technology and also who owns and who determines the future directory of technologies. So
that's right.
Are you following the named data networking technology at all?
You know, and I think personally today we're so close to having it, it's not funny, and I think perhaps we've even built it. I'll take a Cloudflare example because it is a good example and they're great people. There are others, so don't think they're the only folk. But when I put my content on their network, it does not have an address anymore. Whenever I go to find my website, it gives me an address of the closest local data, wherever Cloudflare might be. And I send my traffic to that data center and then I see myself. So my content doesn't have an address.
Just
it has
a name.
A care of address. Right.
A now, URL. I'm on a it's usually a URL as a name.
I don't have an address because I'm behind some NAT somewhere deep inside the telco system. That's fine. So all of a sudden, something without an address, me, is pulling content from something without an address, my server. And the only thing we're actually managing to make this work is its name.
Right.
Named data.
Yeah.
Now you go, hang on a second. Don't those names need to be unique? Don't those names mean to be something? I'm pretty impressed with Netflix. I'm like, we all are. It's taken the world by storm. But Netflix.com is not Netflix.com the world over. If I use Netflix.com and I'm in the United States, geographically, evidently, according to the IPR folk, I see a certain catalog. Netflix.com means some collection of material. In Australia, it means a different collection. Smaller and different. So it has the same name, but it's not the same thing.
But you still pull, so the URL might be the name of the domain, but the URI, which is the full, which is, you know, the protocol, the domain name, you know, www.netflix.com, for example, and then the URI, which is the rest of the URI, which is ///directory/, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's actually the full name. We need to make sure that we define the concept of name correctly. Objects get names, not just sites. And every object has a name.
When we thought about the URI scheme, again, we thought about telephones and global addressing. Hmm. The URI was meant to be a public thing.
Yes.
But again, the content folk took that entire model and put it through the blender, you know, and back came fragmented, shattered bits. What happens on the other side of netflix.com/gobbledygook is relative to today, to me, to you, to the data center. In other words, I can't recycle that right-hand
side. You're saying
side.
It's not an absolute, it's a relative concept.
Oh, it's a computed concept. It has nothing to do with storage path or a file system
anymore.
So
not only is it relative, it's also transitory.
Totally. Now, you kind of go, well, isn't that weird? And you go, well, no, that's actually named data networking. That's what we wanted in 1970. So here we are in 2016, sitting on a network that we actually wanted 40-odd years ago. This is the one we want. Mm. And what do we hear back? Oh, NATs are bad. It's kind of goes nuts. You are completely, totally loony. NATs actually hold this entire thing up.
Well, the problem with NATs is, so yes, I think
no
the point you're making
NATs.
Is that, I agree with you. I think what you're saying is it's not that NATs are preventing us from, you know, in a sense, we've got this network regardless of all these network address translation gateways in the internet. But the flip side of the network address translation gateways is because they manipulate the protocol, they prevent us from moving TCP/IP forward because they break all of the middle boxes in the internet, firewalls, NAT gateways, proxy servers, IDSs, you know, all those things. They prevent things like PMTUD, like ICMP echo replies saying that the fragmentation is needed and all that.
Right. So what they prevent you from is being lazy. You've actually got to think a little more. And interestingly, when you drop addresses out, you go, well, I can't trust addresses. You actually start to be far more innovative. Google's quick transport protocol is a breath of fresh air.
Yes.
You know, after 30 years, we've finally had a new thought. Wow. And it actually is address agile. It works through NATs. The NATs can change the addresses at arbitrary times. Mm. Quick just goes, oh, yeah. and just moves on. So all of a sudden, I think when we actually looked at the network today, a whole bunch of subtle little changes are taking place that we dreamed about as being a utopian existence back in computer science days in the 70s. And now that we have it, all I hear is folk going, oh, yes, well, but NATs are bad, V6 is good, blah, blah. And it's kind of, that was a model of networking that's a bit like the horse and buggy. We're not using that anymore.
You know, NATs have never been – well, I've always had a love-hate relationship with NATs in the sense that NATs, you know, NATs were very necessary. They were a great way to get, you know, to take a /24 and turn it into a 10/8.
It made us think differently, and that was the bit because, you know, content needed to move. All of a sudden we started to use NATs on the other side of the equation as well, and it kind of liberated the thinking. And, you know, we started to solve very real problems. We solved them in ways that weren't, oh, well, just throw more addresses at the problem, take the lazy way out.
Yes.
The DNS is now completely different.
Mm.
The whole attack system is now completely different. DDoS attacks are different today than they were, you know, decades ago. And part of it is NATs make an evolved thinking.
Well, I think the other thing too is, I mean, I've been researching HTTP2 more deeply this week, and you're looking at things like originally the HTTP 9.1.1.1, they used one TCP connection for every HTTP connection. Although HTTP 1
that was a mistake. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was watching a video today about a researcher saying actually it made sense when networks were lossy. So where the loss is greater than 2%, having a single TCP connection for each HTTP actually performs better over a very wide range of tests. But when you get to very low loss networks, say less than 0.1%, having a separate TCP connection for each one and then multiplexing all of your HTTP requests over a single TCP session actually starts to outperform. I can link you to the video. It's O'Reilly.
You're quite right because in essence, the way it kind of works is as long as you keep a session state going long enough, the two computers at either end, if they're doing the right kind of flow control protocols, get to sniff out what they can do as a flow in competition with all the other concurrent flows they're sharing the wires with. And the longer you hold that flow and the more you sniff, the better you get at it.
Yeah, you hit C-win, you know, and you get maximum transfer rate. Yeah.
The first time you drive your car to work down a new route, you know, it's a bit of an adventure. By the time you've done it for 15-odd years, you might as well be asleep because you understand what everyone else is doing. You understand what you have to do. You can optimize yourself in relation to everyone else. Yeah. Well, TCP is no different to that.
Yeah, the congestion window stabilizes and you get maximum throughput. It's not varying as the
time. Right, so then you look at, well, what's this 2% loss? What are we actually aiming for here? Yeah. In a network where 70% of the traffic was long distance, that was something you have to worry about.
And the backbone was often congested. True. So
right. Yeah. In a network where 90% of your traffic is coming down 5 milliseconds of delay, and I'm trying to optimize for the 90%, I can do entirely different flow control, you know, and I can actually jam the pressure from my flow. I can dial it up to an intensity of 100 on the assumption that if everyone else does that too, we'll make the wires melt. We'll make everything work, but geez, it'll be fast, you know.
I guess there's a secondary effect is as the backbones get less loaded because we're caching content or moving content towards the edge, then their latency and their loss also stabilizes at a lower level.
Right. So now it's feasible for iCloud to actually offer to back up gigs. I can take gigs of data from your home machine and drop it into some local cloud. Couldn't have done that 5 years ago, possibly even 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Feasible now. And so, why is that?
So you think quick? You think quick is going to work? I mean, I'm pretty convinced that quick. So for the people not listening, QUIC is a protocol largely developed by Google and moving through the IETF, and it allows you to run HTTP/2 over UDP instead of TCP. And the primary reason for running it over UDP is because all of the middle boxes in the internet prevent us from implementing new protocol features or TCP traffic shaping or rate control or flow control. And because all the boxes like NAT gateways and everything interfere with the TCP flow control algorithms, running it over UDP fixes all those problems. And you've done some research in this area, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah, so all of a sudden, you know, there's a huge amount of middleware going on and it just makes life incredibly difficult. Quick kind of goes, I'm going to hide myself from the network. As far as me, the application is concerned, the network is not my friend. It's actually a hostile enemy space. So what I will do is establish a trust relationship with where I'm heading to, and I will then encrypt the lot and use my own flow control that I'm going to hide from the network. There's no helper. You can't intrude. I'm also going to use a magic 64 bits of session ID that is deep inside the encryption. So no one can touch it. And if my source address changes, as long as my session ID is the same, I'm just there. So it took some of these sort of concepts from other things we were thinking about, the host identity protocol, some work on evolving TCP rate control, taking the concepts behind cubic and bicubic and fast, I think, was another, and dropping them in. Quick is very nice. And they experimented with FEC, forward error correction. Mike, I kind of like where they're going, and I kind of like the idea as well, which is kind of frightening, that Chrome has it on by default. Now, if you look at the world, about 70% of the browsers are Chrome. And all you have to do is set up a web server and say, I can do quick, and you will find an awful lot of traffic is in quick. So it's not just a little esoteric project.
It's an at-scale test in live.
Oh, it's an at-scale environment that, quite frankly, we could all be running UDP and TCP will be a ghost inside a couple of years.
I would say 50 to 60% of internet traffic within a few years could be all UDP. So let me ask you this question. Let me take you a little bit further afield and get away a little bit. So all this, what we've essentially said is, A, the network itself – it needs to be faster, but a lot of traffic is local, so the backbone circuits, the balance of power is moving away. So if you're now a telco and you're looking at network functions virtualization and you're saying, I need to add value to bandwidth, I just can't provide bandwidth for a living because otherwise my business is going to be, my revenue streams are disappearing because people just want bandwidth and I can't add value to that. So if we're now working on protocols like Quick and HTTP/2, we're doing content delivery, which moves content delivery networks, which moves content to the edge of the network. We implement named data networking in, in principle, you know, using content delivery networks to cache or Anycast or, you know, whatever you want to call it. Where do telcos go to make money in the future?
Well, the glib answer is they go to CenturyLink because they're still buying.
Yeah. But I mean, like, the thing is that if they need the way they've done it in the past is that they offer private WAN circuits, which have, you know, SLAs and guaranteed uptimes and reliability. Not that they ever honored the SLAs and not that they ever had the reliability that they promised, right? And
well, I think the internal meetings inside most telephone companies right now must be pretty bleak affairs.
Yeah.
Because while they saw the death of the old hand telephone and the copper network, they still saw the golden light of SMS and mobiles taking its place. And for a while, SMS has sort of got up there and then SMS revenue is declining. Mobile dart voice revenue was up there. Who uses the phone to speak anymore? Mm. We all use Skype. We all use Bypass. I'm pretty sure no one actually dials numbers on the phone and not in levels that give them money.
No,
it's not big enough. Mm. So I think that revenue number is declining. So now they go, well, where do we make money? And the answer is, well, let's turn to the internet, big sigh. Mm. Now, the folk who are employed by telephone companies are telephone engineers.
They're still thinking
all
like,
the folk in sort of in their 40s and older were trained on a different thing. You know, there's a beautiful company in Australia. It's called BHP. They started out, Broken Hill Proprietary, as a bunch of farmers running a mine. And when they figured out their business was mining, they became a bunch of miners, except the activity has changed. They're a bunch of miners running a steelwork. And when they became a bunch of steelers running a petroleum business, every single time that company has had the wrong management for its current activity. The telephone companies are right there with the wrong management for the current activity. The current activity is indeed shipping content around. Their gut reaction is to use their dwindling pool of money to buy content. To make a deal with Fox, to make a deal with anybody. Mm. You know, if they could possibly buy Netflix, they would, you know. But the issue is, are they selling? And the other part of this is that the one thing you're going to do to trigger government intervention from any government is look like you're moving across the border. So when Verizon makes a move on Time Warner, then the FCC might look, because how much content is being wrapped up inside one company?
Yeah.
So in some ways, the telcos are sort of sitting there between their dreams, oh, I've got to buy content, the residual regulatory control, much as whatever is left, and that regulatory control is actually barring them from buying content in many countries.
Mm.
And I think they're kind of stuffed.
Yeah, I think so as well. I mean,
The glib answer might well be find someone who likes collecting dinosaurs and sell yourself.
Well, I think they're going to turn.
CenturyLink is buying.
I think they're going to end up looking like electricity generators. It's a regulated industry at a fixed price that's, you know, on 5, 10, 25-year cycles, you know, investment cycles, and it's infrastructure. It's not innovation. It doesn't change. And all we want from them is bandwidth and a packet loss goal. Knock yourselves out.
I'm not even sure that we'll have that left.
Mm.
I think the golden age of regulation has also died, and the current mantra inside almost every single Western democracy is market-based rules. As long as you're meeting customer requirements, don't bother us. And so, you know, Kindle and all those electronic book readers killed the bookshop. So the libraries are dead, the bookshops are dead, we're still happy, consumers aren't complaining. And so to some extent, that whole industry could fold and die. As long as users don't complain, no one would care. And I'm not even sure there'd be even a regulated residual swamp left for these dinosaurs. They would just die.
What we need is – well, I'm a big fan of less regulation but more safety nets. So, you know, minimum requirements, and if something goes wrong, a safety net's invoked to put the system back into a known good state, a reboot protocol effectively. And I'm not a fan of regulation, but I am a fan of control at some level.
And I think that's what we've got to think about of what the social contract really is. Because it's not the social contract of telephony. It's not a universal service at a universal price anymore. Mm. But exactly what it is in this world is a little bit stranger. You know, certainly we are dead set scared, and historically so for years, about excessive control over content. Mm. Everyone fought with newspaper proprietors. Rupert Murdoch is not the most popular man in the world. You know, massive aggregation of content has its own sort of social fears. And I suspect if you're right, if you do have some kind of safety net or residual regulatory involvement, it's going to be talking about positions of influence in society. And the technology, which, you know, I live and breathe, becomes this sort of tiny side effect of a much bigger problem.
So what I think, the thing I know about media companies is the thing that made them successful wasn't the fact that they had content, it was the fact that they owned printing presses and distribution networks. So,
And now when Cloudflare does it for free, it's kind of, wow, the barriers to entry are just entirely different once more.
Because when we first started putting up packet pushes, we had massive problems scaling the website to handle, you know, 10,000 page views a day. Now I could have put, you know, it took a lot of time and energy to build that. Now I could just put Cloudflare in front of my WordPress instance and scale to millions of views per day. It's a whole change.
Precisely. So now the printing press does unlimited copies for free. You know, we've managed to commoditize that through the kazoo. And now you're looking for the critical scaling points that offer loci of control. And I'm not sure what they are. Technology doesn't seem to be offering control points anymore. We just don't seem to be finding the limits in this new world. And I think part of it is the old world models, transit peering, blah, 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 that had inherent sort of choke points have disappeared. We just don't use them anymore. And so it does bring up these amazing conversations is, what the hell do we need V6 for if we don't need global connectivity? What's the Internet of Things when all these things just simply talk into local data centers? What's security when it's, if you will, uncontrolled edge talking to massively controlled other end, core? Yeah. It's sort of different ways of thinking about these problems. And we're still, I think, only now dimly aware of where those limits might be. It is a named data networking world. We are trying, if you will, for the application to hide itself from other applications, from the device and from the network. It's a very paranoid world as a result. And, you know, to what extent do I reinvent an entire network protocol stack inside my app to hide myself not only from other folk on the wire, but from other apps on my device? Facebook actually give you a full protocol stack in the app. They argue it's because they do it better than Apple or Android. But in actual fact, it gives them full immunity from Apple and Android. It's very hard for the local operating system to spy on that app because it's not sending any signals anymore. So now what we're seeing is general purpose computing, specialized applications. We're moving to a different world. I think it's fun. I think it's just entirely liberating.
Well, I think the internet has always done something one way or another. It's always done something, you know, different. And
it's partially, I think, the technology itself, you know, chips are cheap. And we're only 100 years later, I suppose, thinking about, hang on a second, if computing really is that cheap, what can it do? And it's kind of incredible what we can think about now that we could never even think about 20 years ago. iCloud was an unthinkable thought.
Yes, the idea of backing up your smartphone to the...
through the net. It's kind of instantly available no matter where you are on the planet. It just works. And that's the kind of transformations, I think, that we now have to sort of think about a bit more. And quite frankly, stop engineering for 20-year-old networks. Stop trying to put all the routes in the one fib. Stop trying to think about, well, just in case, I better do this. The answer is you don't need to do it that way. You really don't. You need to solve 90% of your retail problems and leave the rest alone. At least that's what the market will say.
I just think that we're seeing the end of the old telco regime, and that this idea that telcos can add value by putting network functions virtualization in the network and doing, you know, malware scanning at the edge or providing firewall services to the enterprise on a customer-by-customer basis, I can't see how that works out. That doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand when the endpoints are changing to avoid stuff being done, like to... middle boxes are actively being prevented at every phase. Facebook and Google don't want middle boxes. They don't want to leak customer data because of privacy. Customers don't want other companies extracting data. Like, we've got telcos in, there's a $25 billion market selling information that networks get from the internet connections, and they sell that off to ad analytics companies so that you can be tracked better without your permission. It's part of your broadband provider contract, right? And that seems to me to be a short-term game, but I don't see how in the long term they transition from, you know, value-added service provider when bandwidth is the value add. You know, what else do you provide?
It's the old carriage versus content all over again, and we've seen it play out in so many venues, railways, airlines, canal systems. You know, the carriage folk are saying to the content folk, you need me to get from where you are to where your buyer is. You know, I'm part of the equation. I'm going to extract some value. You know, why is Amsterdam a rich city? Because it's on the mouth of the Rhine. Why is Copenhagen? Because it's basically on a choke point of the Baltic Sea.
Yeah.
You know, we're playing this game for almost millennia. Now, with technology, the issue is there's very little carriage role left at this point. The whole carriage industry in this technology world is just waning and flickering out. Now, it could be a pendulum. It could swing back. On the other hand, reptiles haven't ruled the planet for 160 million years, and they're unlikely to come back. You know, news at 10, but, you know, the age of the dinosaur is over. And it may well be that the age of the carriage telco is indeed over, and that CenturyLink paid too much. That, quite frankly, it's not worth anything anymore. That what was once a business is now not something users want. And no one has a right to exist. You have the ability to add value. But if what you're doing...
Well, I mean, a lot of these companies actually have regulated monopolies, highly regulated monopolies. The government, you know, for example, in the US, AT&T and Verizon have, you know, very deep ties with the government there at, you know,
right.
The tie was
manufactured in 1916, and 100 years later, we might well be seeing the need for that, you know, social contract to just disappear. So they might well have deep relationships, but if your job is to make shoes for horses, then you're no longer in a mainstream industry. And my suspicion is that the transit's no longer mainstream anymore. It just doesn't matter. And, you know, that has huge implications for what used to be almost the biggest employment sector in every single economy.
Well, it's also highly, the governments could also highly regulate it too. So... because, it, you know, they could mandate that a company owned it and that company was owned by government. So in a lot of, you know, emerging economies, the telco is a major way to fund the government or for the government to control the populace.
Again, but that used to be the case, no longer.
Yeah.
Laos, 95% of its GDP came from telephone call accounting settlement payments back in the days when people used fax and telephones. Everyone uses Skype, no money anymore. So that entire issue of why you did things as a government and why you did things as telephony, that's also disappearing. You know, all of that old economy just changes and goes away. And as I said, it's not a slight economy. They were the largest single public sector employer in most countries. They were the technology hub. You know, they did all this stuff.
Yeah, I can remember the days when, you know, they were, yeah.
They were big. Now, they're just not important. And all the work... Google, I must admit, does surprise me in so many ways. One of the things that really surprises me is, why did they go public with Quick? It's kind of almost wrong in some way. I'm glad that they did. I like the idea of open source. I think as a technology person, it will only make it better. Fantastic. Thank you, Google.
Yes.
But did they need to? Here's this brilliant piece of intellectual property, this fantastic piece of work.
But it won't work unless they open source it. They have to make because they could put it into the Chrome web browser, but they can't get it into the servers, surely, is one
thing. Well, they can get it into their servers. The real issue is, do they want it into other people's servers as well?
And the answer to that is,
The first thing Akamai did when it bought the intellectual rights for a protocol called FAST was to lock it up and make sure that no one else could use it, only Akamai. And that seems like a typical knee-jerk reaction, you know, mine, all mine, not sharing. Google's kind of going, oh, we'll share. And I find that enlightened. I find it interesting. Maybe my old world reptilian brain is still trying to come to terms with it, but it's certainly a surprising move.
Yeah, well, I guess the stuff that I've read is basically the faster the network works, like the lower the latency, the less time it takes to load a website. Like even a 20% reduction results in a 10% increase in revenue, or less. For Google,
The billion-dollar millisecond has just been out there as a meme for so long, and they're right. Attention spans are slight. you've got to prejudge. You've got to be there. You've actually got to get the content firing just absolutely in your face. Everyone is concerned about that. Mm. You know, and part of this issue is how can I shave milliseconds out of this? Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to shave milliseconds out, why is the global DNS involved? Why is global addressing? You know, if you really want to get stuff reamed out, why don't you look at local context? If you're looking at local namespaces, if you're trying to do things quickly, maybe you can do more than just move content. You've got to think about infrastructure as well. And these are liberating thoughts in some ways, you know. They were pagan thoughts, you know, 20 years ago. Burn him at the stake. Don't think those thoughts. That's bad think.
Yes, but these things aren't allowed to be discussed. You know, you can't get rid of your telcos. But as a matter, you know, they're going to look a lot more like electricity generation companies, I think.
These thoughts, and you can think about, you know, what utilities mean and how do I make the utility as a sort of a carriage function disappear in terms of its value and let the eyeballs in content work far more efficiently. You know, it's the next, I think, 5 years. Again, if you went to sleep now and woke up in 5 years' time, I don't think you'd recognize much anymore. We are moving very quickly to an entirely different world of comms and content.
Yes, I agree. I'd be interested. I mean, I must go and have another look at name data networking and see, you know, how that is progressing, because it had a lot of big names and we're still very much in the research phase. So maybe it's worth re-looking at that, keeping up with where that looks like for a long-term future.
Well, look at that. Look at Akamai's plans. Look at Cloudflare's plans. Look at Google's plans and so on. Look at Facebook and LinkedIn. These are the folk that actually run eyeballs, you know, and those plans make extraordinary amount of difference. Why, when we go to operator meetings, who talks? Those people talk. Who's listening? The entire room has their laptops closed. Sort of, okay, yes. Now I understand where mainstream is.
Well, I mean, this week we saw Facebook announce an optical product, an open source, an open compute project of optical, where they're going to put optical gear inside of what is, you know, an Ethernet switch and start terminating optical connections directly into white box gear. That could really turn around, you know, that changes the nature of telcos.
Yes, yes, and it's a Facebook thing. It's not a telco thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all about Facebook trying to make sure that, you know, it can make its content data work, yeah.
Well, that, and in part, but it also wants to see the carriers put faster bandwidth in, and the best way to do that is to reduce the price of networking equipment. So yeah, there are secondary effects, you know.
Well, I think part of it is trying to get the carriers to invest more quickly, and I think the only way you can do that is to actually disband the carrier and rebuild an entirely different model with an entirely different investor set that's willing to buy current technology.
Well, you're going to have to break the cartels between the vendors and the telcos themselves. The vendors want to sell.
You ever heard that story of why ATM hit Sun Microsystems and hit the mainframe computing area?
No, I don't think so.
ATM was an invention of Bell Laboratories, and Dave Sienkowski was leading the lab. And they were working very hard for the regional Bell operating companies, the RBOX, to build an alternative to the time division switches, the AT&T ESSs. And they were slaving away for a few years, and they thought, we really have something here. So Dave went to report to his telco bosses going, I really think we've got something. And the bosses then said back to him and said, Dave, the equipment in our networks has a 25-year life cycle. We're inside 10 years right now. We've got another 15 to go. Nice work. Pat on the head. Come back in 5 years and let us know. And he's going, what is going on? Yeah. And he went off to Sun Microsystems basically and said, I've got an Ethernet replacement that goes 10 times faster. And they went, sold, bought, done.
Let's go and make that happen.
Exactly. And it's kind of, if you want to really shake the telcos up, let them die. Their whole investment model, their strategy, their backers, everything about that industry is a different generation and it's not this one. And so I don't think they're capable of reforming themselves. The death of transit is a much bigger death than just the transit function of the internet. It really does herald the end of 100 years of dominance of telcos.
Of point-to-point, end-to-end point, because the internet
whole box and dice is now at its sunset years. That's over. You know, and it's just a completely different world now, where in actual fact, we are able to bend the technology, not just to suit anybody's needs, neutral carriage, but to make highly coloured carriage that works for applications and needs, that works for particular content models. And my guess is that over years, I've already said, Netflix's requirements to move data is different to Facebook's. is different to Google's. Mm. And they're actually now able to build custom technology to meet precisely that requirement and ignore all the rest. We're no longer building universal carriage. We're able now with technology to build highly coloured carriage. It's now economically viable. That's a big thing. That's the next 5 years, yeah.
I'm actually relishing it because most of the people I've worked with at carriers need a good kick in the katoosh. And quite honestly, seeing that makes me excited.
Well, it's likely to happen, is all I can say.
Well, it's going to happen in slow motion. Remember, I've got this pet theory that when I first started in IT, everything happened in 20-year cycles. And today, everything happens in 10 years. So it's a decadic pace.
Right. So what's going on is the investment cycle's coming down. And it is a capital issue.
Yes.
And you know, what you're saying, and I think what I'm saying now, is the investment cycle's coming in and closing into even five-year generational cycles.
Yes, I think over the next 5 years, you'll see it come down to 5 years. So the end of this current – so, you know, if you think by 2020, it'll be a five-year investment cycle.
We're going to cut most of the cords. We're trying to rely much more heavily on spectrum. You know, a whole bunch of changes are just on the cusp.
Yes, like things like 5G wireless base stations for telephony, for smartphones, mobile telephony – won't need fiber optic. They won't have to have it because they'll be able to use wireless spectrum for backhaul. And exactly. I can see, you know, that is a huge change. So you put up a base station and then you connect it back with wireless and then 6 to 12 months later you run a fiber in because that's worthwhile doing. But you don't have to have a fiber on day one.
Right. So what's the spectrum allocation models? What's the operator model?
Yes.
You know, is it one provider for all of country? Do we really need that? How localized do we go? And so on. These are all great discussions to have.
Mm.
You know, quite frankly, up until today, the last 5 years, the major wealth generator in spectrum has been the free bit, the Wi-Fi bit.
Yes.
And the whole 4G networks have failed to deliver the dividend.
Mm.
So 5G, everything's up in the air. Hard to tell. But is it worth sticking with the old telco model of cash up front, or do we go to a different kind of model?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you love to be a regulator right now? Because I reckon you can write the rule book. Or maybe you're irrelevant. Maybe the market just writes whatever the market wants and you're sitting there going, what do I do today?
Well, I'm not sure that regulators could write a rule book without sort of – they're always looking back into the past to write the next generation's rules, and they're probably going to get it wrong. But I think the market will move too fast.
But, you know, what a movement. What a movement. What a dramatic amount of change. Very, very quickly. Yeah.
It's going to be very excited, I think. Well, I think that's a pretty good place for us to wrap it up. Jeff, thank you so much for your time. This has been a great discussion once again. Where can people find you on the internet?
Most of me is a small Australian animal, a rather bizarre Tasmanian marsupial called a potoroo. So www.potoroo, and if you potoroo.net, and if you don't like my accent, POTAROO, potoroo.net. You'll find me.
Thanks. And you should really subscribe to Jeff's site on RSS. He does actually get republished on a bunch of other sites, but that's the source. I read every one of his articles. They are often full of data points. They're not just stuff. So there's a link to that in the show notes. I've also put together a bunch of other links to things like Quick, the previous show, 275, which we did with Jeff, where we talked about the state of IP, and some of it overlaps with today's, but moves it forward into terms of that thing. And I've also linked to the congestion control we talked about with Quick and HTTP2 today. Thanks so much for listening to Packet Pushers. And as always, you can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. If you've enjoyed this show, and I sure hope you have, and thanks very much for listening to us, but could we ask you a favor? Could you head over to iTunes and leave us a review? Just give us a 5 stars because that helps put us back into the counting and gets us in front of more people. We need to get more people to join up with the show, or maybe go onto LinkedIn and tell people there that you listened to the show and it was great, or the same on Facebook or on Twitter, wherever it is that you're doing social media. You can also find us on Twitter as @PacketPushers. We're also on LinkedIn, Facebook, and other fine social media outlets. We also have a newsletter, a fortnightly newsletter called Human Infrastructure. You can go and sign up for that. It's where we talk about, well, being a human when you work in technology or in IT infrastructure. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.